From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with writer Elie Wiesel. After he survived the Nazi death camps, he dedicated his life to bearing witness to the Holocaust. His work won him the 1986 Nobel Peace Prize. Actress Patricia Charbonneau didn't get any film work for a while after she starred as a lesbian in the film Desert Hearts. Now she's starring in two films, Shakedown and Call Me. She talks with us about all three. Great Recordings of the Century is quite a name to live up to, and a new series of reissues has taken on the challenge. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on American Sign Language. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. When Elie Wiesel was 15, the Jews of his town in Hungary were forced by the Nazis to live behind barbed wire in a ghetto. In 1944, before Wiesel turned 16, he and all the Jews of his town were deported to concentration camps. Wiesel survived Auschwitz and Buchenwald. Both his parents and one of his sisters died in the camps. Wiesel became one of the first survivors to devote his life to bearing witness to the Holocaust. He's remained one of the most committed and impassioned. In 1985, President Reagan presented him with the Congressional Gold Medal of Achievement. In 1986, Wiesel won the Nobel Peace Prize. The Nobel Committee cited him as one of the most important spiritual leaders and guides in an age of violence and racism. Wiesel is the author of many novels and essays. In a recent essay, he wrote, "Why do I write? Perhaps in order not to go mad, or on the contrary, to touch the bottom of madness." Madness is the subject of his new novel, Twilight. It's about a Holocaust survivor who years later visits an asylum where all the patients have delusions that they are biblical characters. The novel explores the differences between madness and mystical vision. I asked Wiesel if this theme is related to his statement that he wrote to keep from going mad.
I have written so many books, I think around 30 all of them, and somehow they're all connected. One major theme that I think runs through most of my stories, my tales, is madness. I've always been fascinated by madness and haunted by another kind of madness, mystical madness, clinical madness. Today there is so much madness in the world, including political madness, that one cannot not pay attention to it.
What do you mean when you say you've been hounded by madness?
Meaning haunted. I have known madmen in my town, and they had a profound influence on me. And since then, either they themselves are still present, or I'm looking for what is mad. I mean, again, mystically mad in human beings.
I think your new book continues your life work of bearing witness about the Holocaust, but also struggling with the questions raised by the Holocaust.
Well, there too. My very first book was called Night. And all the questions actually that are confronting me today have already been posed there. Man's relationship to himself, our relationship to other people, our fate in humankind, and ultimately, what should be my attitude towards God?
Why have you made it your life work to bear witness?
Well, what else could one do, having gone through certain events? I believe a human being, if he or she wants to remain human, then he or she must do something with what we have seen, endured, witnessed. Not to live through an experience when the experience is there, it's bad. But not to communicate it is worse.
You know, I think that it's almost a human instinct to let time dim memories of horror and tragedy. Have you fought that in a way? Have you tried to keep those memories alive so that you can continue to communicate about them?
Well, naturally. I mean, naturally, the human being wants to forget pain. In this case, all those, or most of those, who went through the experience during the war, they want to remember more and more and more. They go deep into their own consciousness, into their own memory, trying to find more events, more faces, more eyes, more words, more sighs, more tears, more agonies. It's never enough because we feel that we have to tell the story, and no one can tell the story fully.
how often do you find yourself thinking about your experiences in the camps?
Well, I rarely speak about myself. And since you ask, of course, I think about it every day.
Are there certain things that will bring up those memories?
Yes, when I see a child who is hungry, I see a person who is humiliated. When I see what is happening all over the world today, the violence, the stupid, arrogant, grotesque violence that is dominating humankind, I cannot not remember that there were other times, of course. I never compare.
My guest is Elie Wiesel, who, by the way, has written a new novel which is titled Twilight. You once described Auschwitz as the defeat of the intellect that wants to find a meaning with a capital M in history. Do you feel that nevertheless you've been really spending your life trying to find some meaning of the Holocaust, some larger meaning it could tell us about man or about God?
Terry, all the questions I had remain open. I really don't believe that I found any answer to any one of the questions I had. I don't know the meaning. I don't know why it happened. I don't know how it happened. I still don't know anything, really. I'm trying to tell a story, and even the story cannot be told, and therefore it cannot be communicated, and therefore people, deep down, I know, won't receive the testimony that we are giving. We are a very special kind of writers, those who write about that event. And I write very little about it, really, but I know that people will not understand.
Well, in fact, I think when you started talking about the Holocaust, you found it very difficult to find people who would listen.
Oh, nobody wanted to listen. My first book, Night, which appeared in France in 58, we couldn't find a publisher for it. Finally, we found a very small publisher, a marvelous man, Arthur Wenck, who I think gave us $50 in advance, and maybe 3,000 copies were printed. I don't think they were sold. Nobody read. People didn't want to listen.
Why do you think that changed?
Slowly. First of all, we've worked slowly with children, with their teachers. It was a slow process. And deep down, I think also, people began understanding that here we are confronted with an event unlike any other, which cannot be compared to any other event, unprecedented. And it is an important event. I believe this event to be the most important event of the 20th century and perhaps of all centuries. And therefore people somehow wanted to know more.
I think when you were in the camps, you saw some religious people stop praying and saw people who had not been observant turn to God. You had been very observant and very immersed in the religious texts when you were young, before you were deported to the concentration camps. How did your experiences and your survival in the camps change your own experience of religion?
Well, the change, to the extent that it occurred, did not occur there. It's afterwards that the problems became urgent. Inside that universe, we continued praying, we continued believing, we continued affirming. We needed that link with our past. It's only after the war that I began asking questions and I began articulating a certain protest. And that protest is still with me. I am still angry at all the forces in history that provoked such a catastrophe. That doesn't mean that my fate left me or that I left my fate. I try to develop a certain protest within fate.
Have you gone back to the religious texts that you were reading when you were young?
I never stopped reading or studying. Even inside that universe, I studied. I had a teacher there whose name I never knew and whose face I hardly saw. But he was a teacher, head of a Talmudic school in Galicia. And we worked together and we studied together. I know it's incredible.
This is in the camps?
Inside, in Auschwitz. So we studied. We kept on studying from morning to evening. And after the war, the first thing I wanted was a book, was a Talmudic treatise. I never stopped studying. That probably saved me.
In your new novel, Twilight, it's partially set in an institution where all the people who are mad envision themselves characters in the Bible. And one of the people in this institution thinks that he is God. And he is asked all the questions that, well, some of the questions that you have, I'm sure, asked yourself about how God could enable something like, could allow something like the Holocaust to happen. What does it mean in terms of your understanding, your feelings about God, that you've created this character who is mad and thinks he's God and maybe is God? It's very ambiguous.
Oh, please, I think it's deeper than that. I created a character who thinks that he meets another character who thinks that he is God. Oh, God, if God answered, he answered in his language, whereas we asked questions in our language, and I'm not sure it's the same language. So we keep on asking, interrogating, questioning. The silence of God is God.
In your first novel, Night.
Night was not a novel, it was a memoir.
I don't know why I think of it as a novel.
No,
I think of it as a very autobiographical novel.
It is autobiography, but yeah. Every word is true.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about your religious teacher who narrowly escaped from being murdered with hundreds or thousands of other Jews in the forest by the SS, and he somehow managed to escape and come back to your village to warn people about what was happening, and no one would listen.
We didn't listen because he was a simple man. He was a beadle. Had he been an important person, I think some people would have listened. What is so extraordinary is when we remember today the silence, the indifference of so many people who were not inside the tragedy, but on the other side. Just imagine if we had heard on the radio Ben-Gurion from Israel, or Roosevelt, or Churchill, telling Hungarian Jews, don't go because they are killing, they are massacring. I think we would have believed them. But why should one believe a beadle, a man who came back from the other side and who is telling such atrocious stories?
Well, getting back to the question of madness, I think a lot of people in your village just assumed he'd lost his mind and was was having visions or something, that this couldn't possibly have happened.
Oh, absolutely. I myself, I was very close to him. And we spent many, many hours alone together every evening. And I would listen to him. First, I love to listen to stories, even to his stories, maybe especially to his stories. But I didn't believe them.
Did you do anything to mentally prepare for what was in store when your father told you that the next day the whole village was going to be deported, the whole ghetto was going to be deported?
No, we didn't know. See, Hungarian Jewry was deported at such a pace. Everything came so fast. Look, the Hungarians allowed the Germans to come in March. The end of May, all the Jews were out already in Germany. In less than 6 weeks, Eichmann had managed to deport to their death more than 600,000 Jews, men, women, and children. So it came very fast, and it ended very fast. We didn't have time to think.
You've described yourself as having been very weak and sickly when you were young. I know you think of yourself as having survived purely by chance. Did you learn things, though, to help you survive when you were in the camps?
Oh, no, not at all. I was the wrong person, the wrong candidate for survival. I was always weak, as you said, and disarmed, cowardly. I would never try to do anything which was not what I could have done or should have done. I never asked for a supplement of anything. I didn't volunteer. I was always pleased to think that I could be invisible. Not to make myself visible was my task. I don't know why I survived. I don't know how I survived. It was really by accident.
My guess is Elie Wiesel, who has really spent his life bearing witness about the Holocaust, and he's written a new novel. It's called Twilight. We're going to talk more about his life after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Elie Wiesel is my guest, and he won a Nobel Peace Prize just a couple of years ago for his work. After the war, you were supposed to be repatriated and sent back to your home, but you didn't want to go there. Why didn't you want to return?
Because there was no one waiting for me there. Unlike the non-Jews, really, who were also deported, they could go back to their families, to their home, to their peoples. We had nowhere to go. I knew that my father died. I was there. I was convinced that my little sister and my mother also perished. I had two older sisters. I didn't know that they survived. So why go back? And therefore I was together with 400 other young boys waiting for any country to open its gates for us. Our ideal, really, would have been to go to Palestine, but the British didn't allow us to go to Palestine. De Gaulle heard about our plight and he invited us to France, so we came to Paris. And therefore, really, I feel very close to French culture and to the French humanism, which occasionally one finds even in the highest places. And therefore, all of my books have been written in French, including Twilight.
Did you know when you got out of the camps that you wanted to write?
Oh, I knew that I was going to write before I entered the camps. I come from a tradition, from the Jewish tradition, which believes in words, in language, in communication. And already at the age of 12 or 13, I was writing, of course. It wasn't good. It meant nothing, but I tried to write. I even found the manuscript when I went back to my hometown. It's not good, but I tried. Afterwards, I knew I would have to bear witness. Everyone who was there is a witness. And everyone who was there is a true witness. Others who are trying to speak about this subject occasionally are false witnesses. And I felt that I had to be a true witness, and therefore I decided to wait for 10 years, not to speak about it, not to use language related to these experiences until I knew that the words were true words.
Why 10 years? Why not 5 years? Why not 1 year? No, seriously, what made you think that 10 years is what you needed to really know what it was you wanted to say and what words you wanted to say it with?
Well, 10 is a biblical figure, you know, and it's a good figure. Why not? I cannot tell you that I got up one morning and decided, let's see, is it 5 or 6 or 7? It entered my mind, it has to be 10. I decided 10.
Did you actually have an anniversary where, like, the 10th, really?
Absolutely.
And that day you sat down to write?
Right.
And is that when you started to write Night?
I wrote Night, yes. That's when I wrote Night, on April 11, 1955, which is 10 years later.
And looking back, do you think that this was definitely the right thing to do, to wait those 10 years? In what ways were you changed as a witness and as a writer during those 10 years?
Maybe I didn't change, but the words in me changed. They grew. You know, words have a strange destiny too. They grow, they get old, they die, they come back. Words can be turned into spears. They can be turned into prayers. It's a strange world that you are in when you deal with words.
In one of your essays, you wrote that after the war, you deliberately avoided all contact with Germans and that their presence sickened you physically. Did that change, and if so, what changed that?
It did. Well, I didn't want to go back to Germany, really. I went once because I didn't want to judge people. I went once in the early 60s to do a piece for Commentary. And I realized that every person I see in the street, I judge him or her, asking where was he, what did he do, how old is he, could he have been there? And I didn't want that role, so I didn't go back. But I did go back last year, or in 86, 87. And look, today you have a young generation of Germans, and I do not believe in collective guilt. So I have absolutely no problem with the young Germans. I even feel sorry for the young Germans, because to be maybe sons or daughters of killers is different than to be sons and daughters of the victims. And I felt sorry for them. I still do.
Writer and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel is my guest. You have a son, and I'm wondering if when your son was born, it helped give you a reason to live beyond bearing witness?
Well, it's enough, you know, to bear witness can be a very exalting undertaking. To have a son is also to bear witness. A son who has the name of my father is an important statement. But it is true that the birth of my son divided my life.
Did you find yourself reliving your childhood memories as you watched your son grow?
Terry, my son would not like me to talk about him.
That's fine. Let me drop it then. I understand that fully. You said something about bearing false witness before, that you wanted to bear witness because there were others who would bear false witness. And I wonder if you see a lot of examples of false witness around you now. And by that I mean maybe some of the movies or novels or something that you might think don't ring true or...
Well, there is too much vulgarization and commercialization and trivialization mm-hmm. of the subject. It's much too much. It began years ago, and the wave is rather high. It goes too far. And these, I believe, although the intentions may be good, but these are statements made by false witnesses. The Holocaust is not a cheap soap opera. The Holocaust is not a romantic novel. It is something else. Now, furthermore, that there are even people who totally deny that it existed. Today you have many, many pseudo-scholars who totally deny that Auschwitz ever existed. So I believe that faced with the embellishment of the tragedy on one hand and the denial of the tragedy on the other, we who are still here must pick up as forcefully and gently as possible and say, look, this is not the way it was.
The generations of survivors are getting older. The older generation of survivors is no longer with us. Are you concerned about what's going to happen after the generations of survivors pass on? Like, who will be around to actually speak the memories?
Oh, I'm profoundly concerned, naturally. In one of my novels, I try to describe that feeling of the last survivor, what it means to be the very last. And I would not want to be that last survivor. But on the other hand, we are leaving a legacy. We are bequeathing a certain message, a certain story. This tragedy is the most documented tragedy in recorded history. And therefore, later on, if there will be a later on, anyone wishing to know will know where to go for knowledge.
You won the Nobel Peace Prize a couple of years ago, not only for bearing witness, but for the work that you've done with current tragedies. When did you start thinking that you wanted to not only bear witness, but to apply that somehow to current disasters?
Well, for many, many years. I think it began in the early 60s. First, I went to the Soviet Union to see the plight and the resistance of Soviet Jewry. And that drew me into the field of human rights. And I broadened the scope of that activity because I do believe that as a Jew, I should, of course, see Jewish concerns as my priorities. It's only normal, it's only natural, but they should not be exclusive. I do not believe that as a Jew I have the right not to know what is happening to the poor people in Africa, to victims of oppression in Asia or in communist countries. I do not have the right not to know and not to try to help.
What kind of action do you feel you can take to try to help?
Well, what can I do? I'm not a politician. I have no position. All I can do is write. I can take a few words and publish them. I went to help the Miskito Indians. I published in all kinds of newspapers, press conferences. I went to the Soviet Union. I wrote a book. I went to Argentina. I wrote about it. Wherever I go, again, it's one more way of bearing witness.
In a way, you recently bore witness to President Reagan before he went to Bitburg, to the cemetery to speak there. You spoke with him. You spoke to him publicly in a public address, but I think you might have had a personal audience with him as well, did you?
Oh, I'll tell you, I tried, you know, to be respectful, and I think I was. And he by the way, he thanked me for it. I showed him my speech before I delivered it, a day before I made that statement in the White House when he gave me the Congressional Gold Medal. One day before, I wanted him to read what I was going to say. One does not surprise a president. It's not nice. It's not to be done. So I did that, and I met him that morning too, just an hour before the ceremony. I'll tell you, I think it was a watershed. I think it was the wrong thing to do. I think he, from his viewpoint, he felt he had no choice. But somehow, there must be justice in history. All the people who were involved in the Bitburg affair are out of the White House now.
Your new novel, Twilight, is the first novel that you've written since receiving the Nobel Peace Prize?
No, I've written it before. I published it after.
Oh. Well, in that case, and then I'm still wondering if getting that prize was intimidating at all and has made it more difficult to write, you know, living up to the Nobel.
No, I really don't think so, because when one writes, one doesn't think of prizes. It made it more difficult afterwards. People somehow do not receive it the same way. A Nobel laureate carries a certain mystique, which is silly. And therefore they judge the book differently. If the same book had appeared, let's say, 10 years ago, it would not have been judged the way it is being judged now.
You mean you're being judged as the Nobel winner?
As the Nobel winner. So people expect different things from a Nobel winner.
Is this helping you or hurting you?
Neither, really. This is my 30th book, so it's not something that touches me.
Are you in the middle of writing another book now?
Oh, I always am in the middle of writing a book. I never give a manuscript to a publisher before I've begun another one.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Elie Wiesel, and he's now a professor in the humanities at Boston University. He's the author of more than 30 books. His new book is titled Twilight, and it's just been published by Summit Books. He won his Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Paul Morrissey. In the 60s, he was part of Andy Warhol's crowd, and he directed many of the films Warhol produced, including Trash, Flesh, and Heat. More recently, he directed Mixed Blood, and he's got a new film that's titled Beethoven's Nephew. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. actress Patricia Charbonneau made her screen debut playing a lesbian in Desert Hearts, a role she says won her a bit more admiration from fans than she was ready for. Coming up, we talk about that and her two new films, Shakedown and Call Me. Also today, classical music critic Lord Schwartz evaluates whether a new series of reissues called Great Recordings of the Century is as great as its billing. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg explores the cultural significance of American Sign Language within the deaf community. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Today, federal judge Gerhard Gesell ruled that the four defendants in the Iran-Contra case, Oliver North, John Poindexter, Richard Secord, and Albert Hakim, must have separate trials. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Judge Gesell said that when Congress granted three of the defendants limited immunity from prosecution last summer to force their congressional testimony, that immunity grant made a joint trial impossible. The reason is that each defendant was guaranteed that nothing he said to Congress could be used against him at trial, and at a joint trial, defendants would want to use each other's immunized testimony to cross-examine witnesses. If, for example, Oliver North wanted to use John Poindexter's immunized testimony at a joint trial to cross-examine a witness, that would violate Poindexter's constitutional right not to incriminate himself. And so, concluded the judge, there must be four separate trials. Independent counsel Lawrence Walsh vigorously opposed separating the four defendants. He said today, four trials will be more burdensome and difficult. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Michael Dukakis said today, Jesse Jackson is among those he is considering as a Democratic running mate, but he said he is going to cast his net far and wide before making his choice. Last night, Dukakis swept the final four primaries of the pre-election season, giving him enough delegates to clinch the Democratic nomination. At a news conference in Los Angeles, Dukakis was asked about the possibility of a Dukakis-Jackson ticket.
That he deserves consideration, that he's done a very, very impressive job of running his campaign, of being a strong candidate, but that there will be other people who will be considered as well, and it'll be up to the nominee, as he himself said, to make that selection.
For his part, Jackson has made it clear that he expects more than passing consideration for the number two spot. Consideration, Jackson said, does mean an offer. Jordan's King Hussein told Arab leaders meeting in Algiers today that the Palestine Liberation Organization must be at an international Middle East peace conference. It was the king's second speech to Arab leaders. The special summit was called to discuss the Palestinian uprising in Israeli-occupied territories. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
21 Arab leaders met in closed session today. The Jordanian king told them that the U.S. peace initiative remained a dialogue between the U.S., the Soviet Union, and concerned Arab states. His speech was a call for Arab leaders to find a realistic political stand for peace negotiations with Israel. While the king said the PLO must represent the Palestinian people at a peace conference, he advised that if the summit supported a separate PLO delegation, it wouldn't lead to a peace conference. At the same time, King Hussein said the U.S. had no Middle East policy except to support Israel. King Hussein reminded the Arab states that a 10-year financial commitment to support what's called the confrontation states is ending this year. He made an appeal for renewed funding for Jordan and Syria. In Algiers, this is Deborah Amos.
A Palestinian youth who was beaten by Israeli troops yesterday died in a hospital early today. According to his family, the teenager was beaten by troops in the Jabalia refugee camp in the occupied Gaza Strip. He died overnight in a hospital. The Israeli army denies the family's charges. The Israeli-appointed mayor of the West Bank town of El Bira, who was stabbed yesterday, remains in critical condition today. No other disturbances in the occupied territories were reported. The Senate today fell short of the two-thirds vote needed to override President Reagan's veto of the trade bill. The legislation would have mandated retaliation against unfair foreign traders to open overseas markets for U.S. exports and set aside money for retraining displaced American workers. Mr. Reagan vetoed the bill because it would have required businesses to give workers advance notice of layoffs. The House voted to override the veto on the same day the president took his action, but without a two-thirds majority vote, the bill dies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. How many of the so-called great recordings live up to their reputations? Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of some old recordings that have just been reissued in a series of mid-priced discs billed as the great recordings of the century.
When I started to collect records, one of the most important discoveries I made was that some scratchy old performances transferred from 78s were greater than anything I'd ever hear in hi-fi. I learned this mainly from a series called Great Recordings of the Century. They all had the same cloth-textured jacket with the same code letters, C-O-L-H, and each one included a gray booklet that told you just what you needed to know about the performers, their interpretations, and the works themselves. Angel Records has just begun to reissue them on a new CD series. The invaluable program notes are gone. The vocal discs don't include either texts or translations. How can a new listener tell how moving Hans Hotter really is in Schubert's Winterreise, or Shalyapin's Russian songs and arias? Still, the performances remain unequaled. They're inexpensive, and they've never sounded better. There are several interesting surprises. A Wanda Landowska Bach disc includes her first and far superior harpsichord recording of the Goldberg Variations from 1933, I think the first time it's been issued in this country, as well as her chilling version of the Chromatic Fantasy and Fugue. Some post-war recordings have also been newly elevated to the status of great. These include such choice items as Dennis Brain, probably the greatest horn player ever recorded in all four Mozart horn concertos, Claudio Arrau's Chopin Etudes, and Heitor Villa-Lobos conducting four of his own Bachianas Brasileiras, with Victoria de los Angeles singing and humming along with the cellos in the famous number 5. There's Kathleen Ferrier's heartbreaking version of Mahler's Kindertotenlieder under Bruno Walter, which first appeared in America on the Columbia label. There's Kirsten Flagstad as Dido in the Mermaid Theater production of Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, with the young Elizabeth Schwarzkopf in three different roles. And the first and more radiant of Schwarzkopf's two recordings of Richard Strauss's Four Last Songs. There's an exciting recital album by Bulgarian soprano Ljuba Velich, who is probably the most sexually uninhibited Salome ever to play the part. Her terrifying little nymphette voice could actually cut like a dagger through Strauss's huge orchestra. The version of Salome's final scene released here isn't the famous one conducted by Fritz Reiner, under whom Velich made her sensational American debut. It's an even more blisteringly erotic performance from 5 years earlier, a 1944 live broadcast on Austrian radio conducted by Lovro von Matejczyk. The uneven sound quality has nothing to do with transmission. It's merely Velich melting the microphone. Of course, these are only the tip of a magnificent iceberg. When are we going to get Artur Schnabel's complete Beethoven sonatas, Joseph Szigeti's Bach, Landowska's Scarlatti, at least the landmark Pablo Casals recordings of the Bach solo cello suites are already on the summer agenda, and I can't wait.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new series of reissues on the Angel label called Great Recordings of the Century. This is Fresh Air. Until recently, filmgoers only knew actress Patricia Charbonneau from her role in the movie Desert Hearts. She played a young lesbian who falls in love with an older woman on the verge of divorce. This season, Charbonneau appears in two new films, Shakedown and Call Me. Shakedown is an action film, and she plays a district attorney opposite Peter Weller. But her role in the thriller Call Me is less conventional. She plays Anna, a columnist for an alternative New York weekly. In the opening scene, she gets an obscene phone call, which she thinks is her boyfriend playing a practical joke. She agrees to meet the caller in a bar, where she witnesses a murder. She realizes the caller wasn't her boyfriend, and she suspects it was an attractive but sinister character at the bar, someone possibly involved with the murder, who tried to pick her up. The anonymous calls persist. They scare her, but she's attracted to the caller.
Look, you're not getting the message. There's no point in calling. I have nothing to say to you.
It was my fault.
It happened at the Polish bar, you stupid jerk. In the woman's toilet. Is that kinky enough for you? If it wasn't for your stupid idea of a joke, I wouldn't have been there in the first place.
Are you okay? Are you in trouble? How did you see it?
I was in the right place at the right time.
I have a theory about this movie, that a lot of men and women are uncomfortable with the movie because they're not sure of what to make of the sexual politics, and that they think, well, maybe a woman shouldn't ever have dangerous fantasies, and maybe therefore they shouldn't like the movie.
Yeah, I see. That's what attracted me to the script, actually. I thought, this is great. Here's a woman's fantasy from a woman's point of view, and trying to stay in control of that fantasy until things get a little out of whack.
Is that what made the character plausible to you?
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever had problems with anonymous phone calls or obscene phone calls?
Actually, while we were shooting this, I got a very strange phone call. A director, supposed director, had called me, and I was night shooting, and he said that he knew that I was night shooting and that he was in town, and he'd really like to have lunch if that was possible. And I said, sure, great. I called my agents to find out if this director was really in town. They says, oh, yeah, and he really is, you know, casting something right now. So I went down to Soho and sat at a bar for a half hour, and no one showed up.
This is a lot like in the movie.
It's exactly it, because I walked into the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and I went, I'm living out this movie right now. And I left. Nobody got murdered.
Did you ever find out what happened?
No. I thought maybe it was somebody on the set, but I was really upset about it, and I asked if anybody had done it to please come forward, but they didn't, so I assumed that it really was. Well, because I do get some strange phone calls from time to time.
You appear in two movies that opened at just about the same time.
Yeah.
Shakedown, which was really an action thriller that right. starred Peter Weller, and Call Me. One of them is a big commercial film. The other's a small personal film.
Right.
Was it interesting to you to watch how each of those films ended up getting distributed and publicized?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, the different distribution is quite different. I mean, I think Call Me was only in like 14 markets, and Shakedown opened up in like 1,600 theaters.
Did you start to really think that movies indeed are dependent on the amount of money in back of their distribution and publicity?
It's hard to say. I think a film like Call Me shouldn't be in 1,500 theaters. You know, I really don't think too many. It's hard to say. I don't know that part of the business very well,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's tricky. I feel that maybe Vestron lost a little. I think they don't like the movie, to put it bluntly. And because I don't think it was packaged all that well.
And you think when a distributor doesn't like a movie, they can easily kill it?
I think so, yeah.
Your first movie role, at least the first one that I saw, was Desert Hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And Helen Shaver played a Columbia professor who goes to Reno to get a divorce. You played a 25-year-old woman, a lesbian, who lives on the ranch where she stays. You fall in love with the professor. She seems to be in love, too, but resists it because she's not comfortable with the idea of a lesbian relationship.
Are you okay? I've been better. Yeah, I know what you mean. Why didn't you come? I guess I'm scared to death of never seeing you again. Kay, you gotta let it go, you know that. Stop it. I want you to open the door. And I want you to leave me alone. I can't. Honest.
How did you get the part in Desert Hearts?
Donna had seen about 100, 200 actresses in L.A.
This is the director, Donna.
Yeah, Donna Deitch, yeah. And she had just seen quite a few actresses in L.A. and was not happy with what she was coming up with. So she came out to New York, and literally my picture was on a table. And she picked it up and she said, well, this looks the way the character should look. And she called me in and we met, and I was feeling particularly feisty that day. And I had a really great audition with her, and then I came back the next day and we talked, and then that was Friday, I think, and then Monday we just sort of had coffee together and we talked about the love scene and how I would feel about playing a character like this, and she offered it to me that Wednesday.
I bet after seeing the movie that a lot of women got crushes on you.
Yeah.
How did you, you're heterosexual, how did you deal with it?
It was a little strange at first, because first I got both male and female response, and then I was getting like flowers sent to me and letters sent to me and dinner invitations and this and that, and it was just sort of getting a little irritating actually towards the end, because I don't understand how people can intrude on someone's personal life like that. You know, when you're playing a character, I mean, some people, you know, I felt really actually needed like some help, because they would write to me as if I was their psychologist or psychiatrist, and I have no answers about the wisdom of the world. I'm just living.
It was the kind of role, I guess, where people forgot you were acting.
I guess so.
It was a very good performance, but you didn't seem to work a lot afterwards. Were there any connections, do you think, to playing a lesbian and not getting a whole lot of offers after the movie?
You know, I really don't know. It's really hard for me to say, because still, of all my work, I am most proud of that role. And it really hurt not to get anything from that. I got a lot of recognition, but, you know, no, I couldn't get any work for about a year and a half. And it wasn't a really great time, because my daughter had just been born and I was broke and I really could have used the job. But I'm not really sure. I mean, I don't think people were so much put off by the fact that I was playing a lesbian as much as I think they thought, well, maybe this is all she can do. Let's wait and see what else she does to see, you know, what kind of an actress she really is.
I know very little about your background. How did you start acting?
Well, actually, I started in theater. Here in New York, I studied with the teacher Fred Karaman and then with Win Hanman at the American Place Theater. And I started at Off-Off Broadway, the production company here, and the 18th Street Playhouse. And then I worked at new dramatists that do new plays. And one of those plays was a play called My Sister in This House, which was then taken to the Actors Theater of Louisville. So I worked down there.
When you started acting in theater, and then when you started trying to work in movies, what were the early reactions to your face? And I ask this in the sense that, knowing that a lot of actors are, at least early on, really typed according to how they look.
Well, when I first came to New York, I was 19, so I was playing very young on stage. I was playing like 16 on stage, 15, 16. And then, I guess in a couple of years, I started like reading for like soaps. But that was sort of, they didn't think I was pretty enough. I wasn't the glamour type, which now I'm really grateful for.
How come?
Well, I'm glad I never got into a soap, to tell you the truth.
Uh-huh.
I think it's hard for an actor to get out of that once you're in. And I don't think it's real great training when you're young, because it's such fast work and you have to just come up with things too fast. You don't get the time to really work on a character. I think that's dangerous for a young actor.
Are you still not the glamour type?
Yeah, I'm still not the glamour type.
Is that good?
Oh, it's fine. It's fine with me.
Have you ever turned anything down?
Yeah, I've turned down a couple of films.
Why?
I just didn't want to play the same kind of character. Right now, I think it's really important for me to find a really strong director. I'm feeling a little bit raw and a little bit all over the place, and I really want to... I had a really wonderful experience with Donna Deitch, and I'd like to find another director as strong as her to work with.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Patricia Charbonneau can be seen in the film Shakedown and Call Me. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, the Senate is set to vote on whether to sustain President Reagan's veto of the massive trade bill. And as you probably remember, that bill was something like 3 years in the making. The House already overrode the veto, but the vote in the Senate will be close. And if it doesn't vote to override, that will be the end of trade legislation for this year. Also, a report on Soviet textbooks. It turns out that high school students in the Soviet Union don't have to take their history exam this year because the textbooks are being rewritten, so it's not clear what the right answers will be to the history questions. And from Florida, the Great Ketchup Scam.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The students at Gallaudet College, a college for the deaf in Washington, D.C., recently made news when they demanded the appointment of a deaf president and got it. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has these thoughts about the language and culture of the deaf.
The deaf students who were demonstrating at Gallaudet College last March had a familiar enough demand. They wanted a college president like themselves who could understand them. But the understanding they were looking for wasn't the vague empathy that comes of having a shared disability. They simply wanted a president who knew their language. The language of the deaf is called American Sign Language, or ASL. Thanks to TV and the play and movie Children of a Lesser God, a lot of people have come to realize that ASL has nothing to do with the system of fingerspelling that many hearing people have seen, where the fingers are used to represent the letters of English words. That would be a slow and cumbersome system of communication all by itself, and it's used by the deaf mostly to render proper names and technical terms that have no signs of their own. American Sign is a full-blown language that's capable of expressing any thought you can frame in English, though its structure is in many respects quite different from English. In fact, ASL is almost mutually intelligible with French Sign Language, which has a similar origin, whereas British Sign Language comes from a different source and is completely incomprehensible to American signers. ASL has been used within the American deaf community for more than a century and a half, so it shouldn't be surprising that it's become the center of a distinct culture, with its own traditions, its own theater and poetry, and for that matter, its own proverbs and puns, though naturally these involve the physical resemblances among gestures rather than the phonetic resemblances among sounds. In order to emphasize this cultural unity, a number of scholars have taken to referring to the deaf community as the capital D deaf, to distinguish it from the small D deaf, those people who merely happen to have hearing disorders. It's important to realize that a lot of the small D deaf never learn ASL or learn it only imperfectly. Some of these are people who lose their hearing later in life, people referred to in the deaf community as newly arrived. But more disturbingly, this has also been the fate of deaf children who were kept from learning American Sign by well-intentioned authorities who believed that the deaf were best served by encouraging total integration into the hearing community. For more than 80 years, in fact, the use of sign was suppressed in the education of the deaf in favor of instruction in speech and lip reading. Throughout this period, ASL survived as a colloquial language, which didn't reemerge as part of the educational process until the 1960s. Now it's used along with English at places like Gallaudet, but even so, it's by no means certain that every deaf child will have access to the deaf culture and its language. The fact is that only about 10% of deaf children learn sign from their parents. The rest have to learn it from outside sources that are somehow made available early on during what linguists call the critical period for language acquisition. If you wait until a child is 12 to teach him sign, he will always have a kind of foreign accent in the language, just like a 12-year-old English speaker who tries to learn French or Spanish. It's a curious state of affairs. These children have a culture that is theirs by right, but they need help in finding it. The success of the student movement at Gallaudet has had an extraordinary effect on the deaf community, but it has also begun to awaken hearing Americans to the special circumstances of the deaf. As Carol Patton and Thomas Humphreys put it in their forthcoming book, Deaf in America, that community is not simply a camaraderie with others who have a similar physical condition, but is a culture that is historically created and actively transmitted across generations.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with Gerald Clark, the biographer of writer Truman Capote. When Clark began his research 14 years ago, he envisioned evenings of pleasant reminiscences in fine restaurants. Instead, he witnessed Capote's long decline and death from drug and alcohol abuse. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Down in the Groove, the new Bob Dylan album. And film critic Stephen Schiff is back with a review of Big, a fantasy about body switching, starring Tom Hanks, Elizabeth Perkins, and Robert Loggia. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome two stations new to Fresh Air, KIWR in Council Bluffs, Iowa, and KUAT in Tucson, Arizona. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landrell. Production assistance from Deborah George, Ed Doherty, and Lisa Bruton, who directed today's show. Research assistance from Martin Foyes and Joanne Springer. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.